This is Dr. Michael Harbin in his teaching on social justice for social outliers in ancient Israel. This is part 4, Widows, Orphans, and Resident Aliens Provisions.
Shalom. I'm Michael Harbin from Taylor University, and we are doing a study on social justice and social outliers in ancient Israel. Today we're looking at the last section, the fourth of four parts, and we will be discussing widows, orphans, and resident aliens, including the provisions that are provided for them. So far, we have looked at the overall structure of the social fabric of the nation of Israel following the giving of God's Torah at Mount Sinai. In the process, we have noted how they settled in villages surrounded by agricultural base of the community, and discussed how that layout would have affected a number of aspects in their society with regard to work, family relationships, and social norms. We then defined the concept of social justice as a balancing, concluding that it's a balancing of two things, two questions. Am I pulling my fair load, the burdens, prescriptive guidelines, and am I getting my fair share of the benefits, which are redemptive guidelines? And both are expected. We then looked at the nature of the extended family, looking within it for an overall pattern of society in terms of relationships. And we looked within the whole situation for the nation of Israel. And we observed that social fabric is a dynamic structure requiring regular mending to retain its strength. We noted how death especially could leave some individuals isolated without a supporting community. And in the process, we noted the text specifically addresses three categories: widows, orphans, actually fatherless, and resident aliens, which we collectively denoted as the wara. At this point, we want to look at specific provisions that God provided to help those individuals. We suggested that the things that the Ora had in common, that they lacked agricultural resources in a culture where most people were directly dependent upon those resources. Without those agricultural resources, the Ora required special social justice provisions, and incorporating a number of social justice provisions, the Old Testament reveals actually four programs specifically intended for this group. First is levirate marriage. Second, gleaning. Third, tithes and third year tithes. And then fourth, Sabbath year garnering. We will now look at those four in sequence. Levirate marriage. We've already mentioned that the first social justice program was levirate marriage. However, levirate marriage applied uniquely to widows. Apparently, specifically widows still of childbearing age. The idea was that a relative would marry the widow with the specific intention of producing offspring who would then take care of the widow in her old age. As such, it would seem that if she already had children, it was likely that a levirate marriage did not occur. Since the term orphan really points to being fatherless, it would seem that the widow would be living with her offspring and taking advantage of other provisions. We see several examples of widows with offspring in the Old Testament. For example, Hiram of Tyre, one of Solomon's key workers in the construction of the temple. He's described as the son of a widowed. The term here now is a widowed woman. This is an adult. Hiram is an adult who became a skilled bronze worker. We're not told where he learned his skill, but apparently he supported his mother as indicated by the declaration that he was a widow's son. In 2 Samuel 14, a woman from Tekoa was brought in to confront David. Her story was that she had two sons. Her husband was dead, and the two sons were working in the field, and they had a falling out. One killed his brother, and thus was subject to execution since it was considered murder. Whether it was an actual or hypothetical situation is not clear, but even if hypothetical, David accepted it as plausible and made judgment. This would suggest an analogous situation existed in the land at the time. The woman, Her concern was the entire extended family was out, had risen up against her demanding justice. That is, to compensate for the deceased by killing the other brother. She feared losing her heir, which would be the person who supported her in her old age. The third example is in 1 Kings 17, where Elijah is told by God to go to Zarephath, which was experiencing a drought and a famine. There was a widow there. She's called a widowed woman. When he got there, he found her gathering sticks to make a fire, to bake her last flour into bread, and that she and her son would eat of it and then die. It's unclear whether the son was too young to work to support his mother, or that she might have had land but could not work it because of the drought. But in any case, through God's direction, her bowl of flour and jar of oil remained full for the entire period of the drought. Subsequently, the boy became sick and died, and God, through Elijah, raised the boy to support his mother. The basic idea seems to be that if a widow had children, it was expected that while she might care for her children while they're young, she in turn could expect them to care for her in her old age. The main premise here is that the expectation that the possession of the family land would be retained by the oldest son, and thus when he was old enough, he could work the land and support his mother. The underlying this principle seems to lie simply in the admonition that widows were to be provided for. In that culture, the widows' children were the primary source of support for the elderly, as we noted in part one. This provision provided only if a widow had no children and was still young enough. So this applied only to widows without children who were young enough to have children. That is, the widow was young enough to have children. The idea is the brother of the dead man would marry the widow. A little more background, Paul provides some commentary on this concept in 1 Timothy 5. Writing to Timothy, he is apparently in Ephesus, a large Greek city. He provides more urban take on the principle. He does not address the question of family land. Rather, he begins with the adamant directive that the children or grandchildren of the elderly widow have a primary responsibility for taking care of her. Should she not have children or grandchildren, then the church should pick up some of the support obligations. This is what Paul calls the list. He does not seem to address situations where the widow has adequate support, but it may be inferred that where there was no need, the church had no obligation to fill it. Today, it would seem that these same ramifications of the basic principles still apply. The family had first responsibilities to support the elderly, especially the widows, followed by the church. The other three... So, as we look at the concept of levirate marriage, the son of this couple then inherited the name and the heritage of the woman's first husband. So, this would be the provision of levirate marriage, intended solely for the widow who had children but no husband. The other three provisions had no children and no husband. The other three provisions seem appropriate for all three groups. Widows of whatever age who had not remarried, the fatherless, who were likely living with their widowed mothers, and unemployed residence aliens. So our second provision is gleaning. This is the primary provision for the wara and applied to all three groups. Gleaning is an age-old process. It entails going back through a field or orchard after it has been harvested to find produce which the harvesters had missed. While this would be a fraction of the harvested produce, it could be a sizable amount. I would note, as a child, my parents' Sunday school class in southern Indiana would actually go out and glean cornfields after the harvest, even though they had mechanical pickers, and then they would pick up enough to... sell back to the farmer, the farmer paid for them to help provide money for the Sunday school class. So gleaning is still present today. Although it is the only illustration we have in the Old Testament of gleaning is Ruth in the grain fields, it's that image that comes to mind. The Old Testament gives guidelines not just for grain, but for all other crops, mentioning vineyards, Leviticus 19, olive trees in Deuteronomy 24, indicating that a person who gleaned would have multiple opportunities through the harvest, assuming that there were farmers who were following the biblical guidelines. The underlying principle seems to be that the farmer planned an intentional margin in terms of production. While difficult to implement in any culture, Israel is generally deemed a subsistence culture, which means that the farmer struggled to harvest enough to supply one family for 1 year. However, Oded Baraski argues in his book, Agriculture in Iron Age Israel, that various innovations during the Iron Age, quote, resulted in a large surplus of foodstuffs, unquote. Biblically, the underlying premise was that if the people demonstrated trust in God, he would provide the surplus. This may be indicated by the situation of Boaz, who apparently remained in the village that Elimelech left because of the famine. And apparently Boaz prospered. While agricultural gleaning is far removed from most people today, the idea of developing intentional margin to provide for one's personal future and to share with others are readily accessible for most. Israelite landowners are given guidelines in Leviticus 19, 23 and Deuteronomy 24 designed to provide for the greatest possible opportunity for would-be gleaners. Succinctly, they are as follows. When landowners harvested grain, they were not to reap to the corners. The grain left standing was intended for the gleaners, that is, for the wara. The text does not indicate how much of a field was left to be unharvested. The Mishnah, the commentary on the Old Testament practices by the early Jewish community in the time of Jesus, indicates 1/60th of the harvest was considered the minimum. It also suggests provision depended upon factors such as the size of the field, the number of the poor, and how generous the farmer was. 2. If a harvester dropped a sheaf, he or she was to leave it behind. In this case, the produce would already have been harvested and bound together. So the harvester has this sheaf of grain and probably carrying a half a dozen or more back to the storage place where they're getting ready, preparing it for either transportation or threshing. And the harvester likely would have lost one. He is to leave it there. In that case, the sheaf was to be left on the ground so it could be picked up by one of the gleaners. 3. The harvesters were not supposed to go back through looking for produce that had been missed. As noted, beyond grain, olive trees and vineyards are specifically mentioned, emphasizing how the gleaning directive covered the entire harvest and not just grain. An olive tree, while the olives will generally ripen at the same time, there will always be some that ripen later, and they were to be left behind. Thinking back through these cornfields, I was always amazed. In fact, even today, I am amazed at how many ears of corn you can see laying on the ground if you walk through a fully harvested cornfield where everything is lying low. In the case of vineyards, the admonition was that if any bunches of grapes were missed, or maybe are just not yet ripe, they're to be left. In the case of olives, the harvesters would use sticks to knock the ripe olives off, and there would be some that wouldn't fall, and they were to be left. And then the gleaner could go through and pick them. Given the scope of produce mentioned, it seems clear that the gleaning directive covered the entire harvest. Now, what I mean by that is they would start with the first grain in the late spring, April, May time frame, and they'll work their way through the wheat and then into the other crops, ending with the olives in the fall. So the expectation was that a gleaner would be able to gather more than just the barley or the wheat or the olives, more than just for the current need. The gleaner would have enough, although likely somewhat on the sparse side, to preserve for the off-season. If so, the gleaner would then also have the same food preservation problems as the farmer. The produce left behind provided an opportunity for the needy. For example, Leviticus 19 mentions this. that they are to gather the residue for their own use. It's significant that the gleaning process provided an opportunity for the Wara to gather food from land which they did not own and for which they had not participated in the sowing and tending of the crops. But they were required to put in the labor to gather that produce, as well as to thresh it, and then to take it home and process it. Given the scope of the crops listed, it would then seem that given, based on the example of Ruth, that one of the Wara was able to follow the harvest from barley, April and May, on into the grape and olive or harvest in the fall. I see two underlying principles for consideration here. The first is the idea of planned margin. When producing, plan for more than you could use. There are two aspects to this. The first is that a person should live within his or her means. For Israelites living on a farm where they produce most of their food, that means that they developed their dietary patterns based on what they had. At the same time, they planned crops. They were to plan on crops adequate to cover their needs. And they would provide a tithe that was left, that was in order to incorporate a tithe so you would have grow enough to give the tithe and still have enough to live on. It would also require them to leave some for the Wara to follow the harvesters. Today, most of us do not live in agricultural communities, but we can still institute a similar practice. It might take looking at what would it take to provide a reasonable lifestyle in person in our position to live. And here we need to recognize that we all tend to overestimate what we need. We can to confuse our wants with needs. We need to add in enough to tithe our income and still have adequate to live on. And then we need some extra for those in need. After comparing this with the income we have, we have to make some choices. We may have to pare off a couple of those needs that we have, or it might require exploring through God's guidance ways to augment the income. For the farmer, it might require expanding what he planted. It might require hiring another worker. The point is that the principle seems to require preparing for being able to give. Let's see. We've already covered this. Greener work. Tithes. Applied to all Israelites, they were required to tithe all their products. By definition, that means that they were to return to God 1/10 of their harvest. This gets a little tricky. The initial declaration of the tithe declaration requirement in Leviticus 27 prescribed that the tithe belonged to the Lord. But in Numbers 18, as this is clarified and amplified, it shows that the Levites represented the Lord in this case as part of their national inheritance. The text says the tithe is for the Levites. Numbers 18 states three times the tithe was to be given to the Levites as their inheritance. This would explain why there were 48 Levitical cities scattered throughout the land. This would explain, they essentially became storehouses for the Levites, these cities. However, according to Leviticus 18, a tithe of the portion that was given to the Levites was to be given as an offering to the Lord. It would seem likely that this was the portion that would be eaten in God's presence, although an option was given to that it be sowed and replacements purchased as the places where God chooses to establish his name. Given the amount of material, a full corporate tithe of the entire nation, how much it would be included, J.A. Thompson is likely correct when he suggests that a representative portion would be taken to the central sanctuary for a feast and the rest stored at local cities. If so, everything beyond the celebratory meal was to be given to the Levites. They would deposit it in God's city. So the tenth of the harvest is given to God. The priest serves as God's representatives. A portion is eaten before God. And then the rest is stored in 48 Levitical cities. However, every third year, there is a different situation. Instead of having the celebration before God and giving the rest to the Levites, it was to be stored in the local towns, Deuteronomy 14. The nature of this third year tithe is not clear, but it seems to provide produce for the Wara as well as for the Levites. Again, it would seem to be stored in each local city. Basically, it would appear that these goods were to be available on an as-needed basis for the Wara in that region as well as for the Levites. As I understand it, this is likely to be a short-term bail them out of a hard situation idea. The text states that it would be reckoned as grain from the threshing floor or the full produce from the vine vat. This would suggest that the produce was processed before it was given and thus was ready for storage and thus for use. While not amplified, this will explain why the tithe was given every third year. It was intended to be a welfare pantry for the widows, the aliens, and the orphans. And it's very interesting, the text says, in the alien and the orphan and the widow who are in your town. So this is a direction to the Levites. Unlike gleaning, there does not seem to be any requirement that the recipient must work for what he or she was to be given. As such, the distribution from the third year tithe would seem to be rather minimal, perhaps a short-term bridge to cover a temporary need. The gleaning already mentioned would then provide for a longer period, perhaps serving the same purpose as food storage in a regular household. If that's the case, this is an aspect of social justice that tends to get lost in the discussion. The principle here is very straightforward. God expected his people in Israel to return one-tenth, that is a tithe. For the Israelites, that meant a portion of the produce that they grew was given to the Levites, who apparently used it for themselves as teachers and guides of Israel, and as well as for the Wara as needed. Interestingly, the New Testament gives no guidance for the church in this regard. This may mean that it was felt that the Old Testament teaching was clear enough that nothing further needed to be said. An alternative view is that giving was to be based on God's leading. Regardless, the principle that a portion of what we earn should be given to God's representatives in an appropriate manner to support those who are doing God's work and to support those in need seems to underlie this entire principle. Our fourth subject or item is Sabbath year garnering. This is a more difficult situation. First of all, the Sabbath year was the seventh year. And the seventh year, the Israelites were not to plant, tend, or harvest. As I develop in my forthcoming commentary on Leviticus, it seems like they were required to do other work around the farm. But the land, and the key is, the text says, the land was to rest. The specific of a Sabbath year are difficult to follow. They're highly debated. There are three primary issues that are related. First, by definition, and the explicit directions given in Leviticus 25, the Sabbath year was every seventh year. That is, a 6-1 cycle. 6 years of growing crops, 1 year of letting the ground rest. Second, was the purpose of the Sabbath year to let the land rest or to provide for the poor? I would argue that the text suggests it was to let the land rest. Although we will see that the poor now had an opportunity to do something that they could not do during a regular year. Third, tied into the second question, could Israelites eat from the Sabbath year volunteer produce? Leviticus 25 seems to say no. Let me rephrase that. Leviticus 25 verses 4 and 5 seem to say no, but verses 6 and 7 seem to say yes. With respect to the straightforward 6th and 7th year cycle, various alternatives have been suggested since it seems very unlikely in the minds of most of us that we would be able to just rest a full year and not have any income. The proposal here is that each individual farmer would leave one portion, 1/7 of his land, or one proposal is that each individual farmer would leave 1/7 of his land to lie fallow each year. And so he would have his land divided up into seven parts and use a different 6 sections each year. Another perspective is that the concept was really just an ideal that was never done. Probably true, but I don't think that that was what was intended. A third approach is that the farmers rotated each year so that only the land of a certain farmer was fallow in any specific time frame. And then the others have to pitch in and help that farmer. Probably the key argument against the universal seventh-year Sabbath is the idea of practicality. Could a farmer in a village last 2 years on 1 year's crop? As one thinks this through, two other factors must be considered. First of all, Sabbath year directions in the Exodus passage are followed immediately by 6th and 7th day directions for the Sabbath day. That would suggest a correlation in the author's mind. 6 days of work, 1 day off. 6 years of work, 1 year off. Second, 2 Chronicles 36 asserts that the failure to observe the Sabbath year was a cause factor for the exile, at least in terms of its length. Admittedly, the traditional understanding is difficult and impractical, but that seems to be the point. The text warns the people not to be apprehensive in the 7 year because God would provide adequate provisions in the 6 year to get them through to the harvest of the 8th year. In other words, people will be given extra in advance. That could serve as a means to reduce the apprehension or anticipation of not sowing in the Sabbath year. Consequently, if they did not observe the Sabbath year, it was not just a lack of faith, but overall defiance, open defiance of God. Thus, it would seem likely here that Kuichi is correct when he states the Sabbath year is to be, quote, universal and simultaneous, extending to all the fields in every 7th year, end quote. Regarding questions 2 and 3 that we looked at here, the purpose of the Sabbath year seems to primarily to be give the land rest. This would have automatically provided rest to the farmer and his animals since they were not to plow or to sow or to reap. A key problem with understanding the Sabbath year as primarily providing for the needy is it was just 1 year out of 7. Although Exodus 23 suggests that any volunteer produce could be picked and eaten. Leviticus 25:6 allows the farmer to participate as well. So it seems Wenham is correct when the organization is when the key is organized harvesting is forbidden. As such, the apparent conflict between Leviticus 25:5 and 25:6 and 7 could be resolved by noting that the basic principle of the 7th year was not to have business as usual. Specifically, during the Sabbath year, the land rested. Everyone was to put an equal basis of trust on God's provision, which means that the farm owner and the wara were on an equal footing. The Sabbath year, like the Sabbath day, served to remind the people that God was the creator and their provider. It served to remind the people that the landowners, that the land was God's and they returned it to him in the Sabbath year. It said they were allowed to walk through, and if volunteer crops grew, they could harvest them. As we evaluate wara provisions, it would appear that the two key concepts noted in part one of the study, which are embedded in the social structure and provided there in a foundation, gave each of them much more of their strength. But there's a third that emerges from the common religious structure of the tradition. Okay, where are we? As discussed in part one, the embryonic nation of Israel emerged from Egypt with a social structure based on 13 tribes descended from the 12 sons of Jacob. When the Exodus occurred 400 years later, that family structure was basically still intact. Although there are a couple of ramifications. While a mixed company came out of Egypt, by the time of the conquest, ethnic outliers apparently had been largely absorbed into the existing tribal units. We noted Caleb as a key example. While not as clear, it would seem that a similar process occurred subsequently with the native tribes who were not eradicated during the conquest. For example, through deceit, the Gibeonites preserved their existence and became servants of the nation serving in the altar of God. Under David, Ishmaiah, the Gibeonite, was a noted leader. And later, Melathiah, the Gibeonite, is noted for assisting Nehemiah in rebuilding the wall and after the exile. As such, there seems to have been a willingness on the part of the Israel to allow assimilation, exemplified by Ruth. However, with respect to assimilation as well as to social justice, it would be the smaller units of the social hierarchy which would be important. What differentiated the two groups is not clear. Joshua 15:19 seems to show basic division by clan, which would seem to incorporate extended families. And this suggests the settlement essentially placed kinship groups within given locations such as the city and the villages. While clearly that kinship structure would underlie the practice of levirate marriage and the goel responsibilities, it seems likely it would also affect the practice of harving in terms of location, the practice of gleaning in harvest in terms of location and associated practices. For example, when Boaz gave general instructions to his steward regarding Ruth's gleaning, it's tempted to tie this to romantic interests, but it may be that he was aware of the goel responsibility since he was cognizant of the closer relative. Given the interrelatedness of the entire village, family ties would likely have heightened social pressures in terms of conformity and provision. This would seem to suggest that the provision for the wara needed to be done on a local level, the village level, where there was adequate knowledge for discernment of fulfilling the needs they might have. Part 1 also noted how an individual farm in a modern village of Kufr al-Ma consisted of several portions of land distributed throughout the fields surrounding the housing area. It would appear that having smaller parcels intermingled through the tilled ground would promote, dare we say, force cooperation between farmers. At a minimum, given the fact that apparently there were no walls, the admonition not to harvest to the corner of their field would have enhanced the gleaning opportunities. The third year tie, that's our third undergirding concept, which is not addressed in part one. While the Israelites were expected to tithe each year, during those two of those years, the tithe was kept taken to the Levites in one of their 48 Levitical cities. This provision was to be kept locally for easy access. This special provision would be collected by the community at large, drawing from its overall harvest. It's very interesting that this provision especially was to be administered by the Levites. While this might suggest a religion system should be the framework around which social justice is built, it also should be noted that when set up, the Levite system was the only national system Israel had. So during the third year, the tithe was handled differently in that it was placed in a storage facility to be distributed to those who had special needs. As the Torah sets up the governing process for the nation of Israel, we'll note these three factors supporting it: integrated extended families, the dispersed land parcels as part of the community field, and the third year tithes. A key portion of these provide several strands of social justice. When summed up in the general statement, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," the concept is spelled out in the last six of the Ten Commandments, which govern relationships. But the Torah goes beyond this when it recognizes human frailties in a fallen world. Although its social fabric was designed to support all members of society through a network of relationships, including extended families and interrelated communities, it also provided Israel means by which the tragedies of life could be ameliorated. For the most part, this social fabric provides limits and protections for all the Israelite society. But the Torah gives special note regarding outliers on the frayed edge of society who might have special needs by providing a special net, safety net for the three categories of people who historically tended to be abused, as we call them, the wara. This study explored how several special provisions were made by for the war against the backdrop of the social norms of the late Bronze agricultural society. In the process, we have noted a balance in its provisions. Three provisions were applied to all three groups. Two required that the recipient work to avail him or herself in the assistance. In the case of gleaning, he or she had to get out in the field and labor to bring in the produce. The same is true in the case of the Sabbath year garnering. In the same time, a second observation is that the provision needed to be made for short-term emergency needs, and the third year tithe seems to be a welfare pantry in the local city where food was stored for the distribution to those who had a sudden short-term need. They'd be distributed by the Levites. There seem to be no obligations with regard to this provision, but since it would be the tithe of just one out of 3 years, it would seem it was not designated for large distributions. A third observation might be that a significant part of the social justice structure would require intentional margin on the part of the overall community. Or, to put it in contemporary terms, living below their means in order to provide a surplus to share. For Israel, the farmer would need to plant enough grain, for example, so that a normal harvest would provide for him, for his family, at the same time have enough for a tithe, and then plenty left over for whoever might glean. This would be a balance to the requirement that the warrior put in the effort or the burden to accrue the benefit. But it also anticipated that God would give the benefit to the farmer in response to his effort or to his burden. And a fourth observation is that social justice was embedded at the local level. In the case of a widow and an orphan, the person would have been living in the village before the husband or father passed away. It's unlikely that the person left the village. It's also likely that the extended family had a significant role to play in addressing the situation. In the case of the third year tithe, the local level was the nearest Levitical city. All these factors indicate that, in essence, we see neighbors helping neighbors, not just somebody living next door, but somebody they really knew. The Old Testament provisions for social liars we have looked at were given as part of a particular social structure and historical context. Specifically, they were oriented towards an extremely homogeneous agrarian society, very different from our own, and they focused on community action largely within a interrelated population. They also built on a single religious system which the entire community was expected to participate. Still, keeping these provisos in mind, the underlying principles noted could serve as a springboard for developing contemporary social justice provisions. Thank you.
This is Dr. Michael Harbin in his teaching on social justice for social outliers in ancient Israel. This is part 4, Widows, Orphans, and Resident Aliens Provisions.